the headlines, Iran says it's sanctioning a number of American individuals and institutions for their serious violation of human rights. The Pentagon says boosting Taiwan's defenses is an urgent task to ward off an invasion by China. Two migrants are back in Mexico as the U.S. reboots a controversial Trump-era program that requires asylum seekers to wait outside American soil. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran will soon release a list of American individuals and institutions it's sanctioning over serious breaches of human rights. The move comes in response to Washington's fresh sanctions targeting a number of Iranian individuals and entities. The U.S. has banned them, alleging rights violations. Secretary of Iran's Human Rights Commission, Kazem Gharibabadi, says that Washington's move is part of the failed maximum pressure policy that uses sanctions for political gains. He says the U.S. cannot claim to be an advocate of freedom and human rights in Iran for the simple reason that it's jeopardized the lives of Iranians by blocking their access to medicine and medical equipment. He added that the U.S. should be held accountable in the court of public opinion for committing violence against peaceful protesters and police killings of innocent people. Senior geopolitical advisor Mr. Alexander Azadegan is joining us now from Irvine, California. Mr. Azadegan, it's great to have you with us. Let's get your perspective on the recent comments coming from Iran. They've stated that they will be releasing a list of American individuals and institutions that it's sanctioning over serious breaches of human rights. Unpack that for us, please.
It's good to be with you, Bardi, as always, and of course, our global audience. I don't even know where to begin. Nobody respects inconsistency. Here in the U.S., we have 35 million people that are hungry or don't know where their next meal is coming from. 13 million of them are children. If another country were doing this to our children, we would be at war with them. I think numbers and facts are important. I think when human rights, women's rights, democracy, liberty, all these things are used as a political ploy, I think it's disgraceful. We started a whole war in the Middle East in 2003 based on lies, based on presumptions that we're going to take democracy to Iraq and all these things. We did the same in Afghanistan in 2001, going there for human rights, trying to spread all these values that we actually do cherish in the West. But our record is a disgraceful one compared to other developed nations like Germany, like Japan. All Scandinavian countries come to mind. So when we use these sacred concepts and ideas that have developed over centuries in order to score a point against a country that is part of the axis of resistance over the transatlantic alliances hegemony all over the world, then we lose credibility. Obviously, Iran's statement today of sanctioning individuals and what have you because of their human rights records is political, it's symbolic. Iran's leverage, if any, over the United States is limited, but it is asymmetrical. So from a political perspective, especially close to the talks that are taking place, in Vienna, Austria, these media and psychological operation tactics and accusations are thrown by Europeans and, of course, the party of war in Washington in order to try to tarnish the image of Iran and other countries, for that matter. you mentioned sanctions. Iran is obviously sending the signal, symbolically speaking, that it would sanction individuals. In this country, unfortunately, we have become addicted to sanctions. You heard the very corrosive comments by Senator Menendez here in the U.S. against Russia, for example, that they're going to cripple their entire banking system. That's just an example. It's not really 100% related to what you and I are talking about here. But this kind of arm twisting, this kind of projection of power, so-called power, is not constructive whatsoever at a time when we need our allies. The world is becoming very tense. We are about to start three conflicts, one with China, one with Russia, and of course Iran. And I think some of these things that are said are acts of desperation. Now, does Iran have human rights issues? Of course it does. Do all countries have human rights issues? Of course they do. It's a question of nuance. But I think we should focus on our issues here in the U.S. When you have a former president hosting an individual, this little boy who traveled all the way from Illinois to Wisconsin, acted like a vigilante, killed two people, and seriously injured a third person, and he's received by this former president, how is that not a violation of human rights? What about white privilege? What about the fact that we've never had a female president? You talk about, you know, human rights, equality, women's rights. I think the global audience is watching. People around the world are watching. Iran, in some ways, is isolated. It's all alone. But it's standing tall, it's standing strong, in a very difficult position economically and otherwise. But I can sit here and cite for you example after example, especially during this lunatic, you know, presidency in the past 4 years of gross violations of human rights in our own country here. Going back to President Obama, the way let me just finish. The way water was so polluted in Michigan, and they sent Obama took a sip of that water. And it was, you know, Michael Moore documented this show, this disgrace in one of his last documentaries. And these people had to actually appeal, U.S. citizens had to appeal to the U.N. for their human rights to be respected. It's just, what are you going to say to that? How could you possibly hide that and shove it under the carpet?
Sure. Apologies for jumping in there, Mr. Azadegan. We're short of time. That was Alexander Azadegan, senior geopolitical advisor, joining us from Irvine, California. Thank you, sir. Moving on, in a few hours, Iran and the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal will return to the negotiating table in Vienna. Representatives from Iran and the P4+1 countries are reconvening to resume from where the talks left off less than a week ago. On Friday, the negotiators went back to their capitals for further consultations. Tehran has already proposed two draft documents concerning its nuclear commitments and the removal of sanctions. The European parties say Tehran's demands go beyond the scope of the nuclear deal, but Iranian officials reject that, arguing that the drafts are in compliance with the previously approved text. The first round of these talks kicked off in April in Vienna with the aim of reviving the nuclear deal and securing the removal of Washington's sanctions against Iran. The United States seems to be ramping up its war of words against China over Taiwan. The U.S. Defense Department says arming the self-governed island is an urgent task. Pentagon's top official for Asia, Eli Ratner, says providing Taipei with weapons and military services will bolster the island's defenses against Beijing. Ratner also says the U.S. is committed to avoiding resorting to force or other forms of coercion that would put Taiwan in harm's way. The remarks are expected to anger China, which considers Taiwan a breakaway province. Under the One China policy, almost all nations recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. We've reached out to political commentator Einar Tangen for comments. He explains what the United States' ulterior motives are in pressuring China over Taiwan.
This policy, really, in terms of Taiwan, has ulterior motives. One, provoke China into some sort of action that would justify everything that the U.S. is saying about China, and saying that it's in essence an aggressive state. The U.S. often uses a ploy where they accuse others of doing what they intend to do. Secondly, by ramping up tensions, they're hoping to get the Taiwanese semiconductor industry to relocate from Taiwan to the United States, quote, for safety reasons, unquote. I don't know that either Taiwan or the businessmen will listen to this. It would, in essence, hollow out Taiwan's economy and give really no reason whatsoever for the U.S. to be interested in Taiwan as an entity. And then finally, there's this, it's just a way of continuing to try to push this narrative that China is somehow evil, repeating on a daily basis unfounded allegations through hearings, through other things, saying that China is doing bad things to its people, when in fact it's one of the few nations that has actually protected its people during the pandemic and also sought to eradicate poverty and bring its people into a better living environment.
The United States has returned the first two migrants to Mexico since restoring a Donald Trump-era immigration program launched to remove asylum seekers from U.S. soil. This comes after the U.S. and Mexico last week agreed to relaunch the controversial scheme known as Migrant Protection Protocols. The program requires migrants to wait in Mexico, sometimes for months, while their claims are processed in the U.S. President Joe Biden suspended the program after taking office in January this year, but he brought it back following an order by a federal court judge in August. Rights groups say restarting the program would incite violence in border camps. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, says the Biden administration is seeking to appeal to centrists for political gains, and that's why it's adopting racist migration policies. Let's take a listen.
You're seeing a lot of black and brown people who are at the border who are facing the very adverse conditions of trying to seek asylum and waiting months at the border or sometimes being returned to their home countries. Let's take the country of Haiti, for example, as we know has been dealing with a lot of tumult in its government and its society. Well, we saw that group of Haitians come to the border. They wanted to seek asylum in the United States, and they were turned away. They were corralled up almost like cattle to some degree, and they had to wait in Mexico. Some of those people were returned to Haiti, and they weren't allowed to get asylum in the United States, while others have been waiting for weeks to get that access. And this is pretty much endemic in this program as well, in these migration protection protocols that the Biden administration has put back into enforcement. And we're seeing a lot of pushback from Democrats who believe that these practices are inhumane because of the fact that people are waiting for months to seek asylum in very subpar conditions. Meanwhile, we do know that the president wants to appeal to a wider swath of people, especially centrists in the political environment, and so he's bowing to pressure coming from those groups that would like to see anyone who is non-white expelled from seeking access into the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden prepares to open his so-called Summit for Democracy on Thursday. The event will be held against the backdrop of the racist approach toward minorities in the U.S. and the humanitarian consequences of America's military adventurism abroad. We have more in this report.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the U.S. is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
Canada and the U.K. say they're planning to diplomatically boycott the 2022 China Winter Olympics. This comes days after the United States staged a diplomatic boycott against the sports event, a move that risks further deteriorating the already strained relationship between Washington and Beijing. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As the Omicron variant of COVID-19 continues to emerge in the United States, top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says that preliminary findings are encouraging. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Thomas Keeker, writing for Newsweek. The piece is titled, Fauci optimistic after early reports suggest Omicron lacks great degree of severity. As the Omicron variant of COVID-19 continues to emerge in the United States, top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says that preliminary findings are encouraging. During a Sunday, 5th of December appearance on CNN's State of the Union, Dr. Anthony Fauci said that while it remains too early for experts to make conclusions, early reports suggest that Omicron variant might result in less severe COVID infections in comparison to the Delta variant, now dominant in the United States and elsewhere. Reports emerging from South Africa suggest that most Omicron patients develop only mild symptoms of the disease. Thus far, it does not look like there's a great degree of severity to it, Dr. Anthony Fauci explained. But we have really got to be very careful before we make any determinations that it is less severe or it really doesn't cause any severe illness comparable to the Delta variant. Based on these early signs, Dr. Anthony Fauci also said that the Biden administration is discussing the possibility of lifting the recent travel restrictions and travel ban on a handful of African nations. The travel bans were ordered after the Omicron variant first began to appear in southern Africa. Hopefully, we'll be able to lift that ban in quite a reasonable period of time, Dr. Anthony Fauci said. We all feel very badly about the hardship that has been put on, not only on southern Africa, but on the other African countries as well. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has criticized the Biden administration's travel bans on countries in southern Africa, likening them to apartheid. The Omicron variant of the coronavirus has been reported in over a dozen states after first emerging in California on Wednesday. Amongst the growing handful of patients with a new strain in the United States, most have reported only mild or moderate symptoms, backing up earlier reports from South Africa. Areas in which the Omicron variant might outpace other COVID variants are its infection rate and resistance to vaccines. Several Omicron patients in the United States were fully vaccinated, and some had even received booster shots. It is currently unclear whether the variant's mild symptoms in such patients are the result of it being a more docile virus or the result of protections offered by the vaccines. During a Sunday appearance on Face the Nation, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that the Omicron variant has not set the country back to square one in the fight against COVID and also gave a hopeful outlook for holiday travel in the United States. We've been at this for 22 months as a country, and the prospect of another variant I know can be exhausting and frustrating to many people out there, the Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said. He added, "And I get that. What I want to say, though, to everyone is that we are not back in March 2020. We're not at the beginning of this pandemic, back at square one. Your risk can be quite low and your holidays can be quite fulfilling. That's what so many families experienced this past Thanksgiving." Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden has announced that health insurers in the United States must cover the cost of at-home COVID testing from next month. Private health insurers already cover the cost of PCR tests taken at a doctor's office, but will now have to cover tests taken at home as well. For those Americans not covered by private health insurance, free tests will be made available at other locations across the country. The bottom line this winter, you'll be able to test for free in the comfort of your own home and have some peace of mind, President Biden said.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Summit for Democracy, with more than 100 nations participating, one held by the U.S. The U.S. President Joe Biden hopes this will assist in renewing so-called democracy in the United States and around the world. But the question many are asking is, what gives the U.S. the right to hold a democracy conference? In this edition of The Spotlight, that is one of the questions we will be asking our guests, and look at why the U.S. is not the democracy that it preaches around the world.
The United States always proclaims itself a leader for promoting democracy worldwide. In line with such mentality, the administration of President Joe Biden hosts a long-promised two-day virtual event, calling it the Summit for Democracy. The event on Thursday and Friday will be attended by over 100 countries. The White House says the gathering plans to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. China, which has not been included in the list of invitees, has challenged the U.S. claim of upholding democracy.
No matter how the U.S. glosses over itself, its true face of seeking hegemony under the guise of democracy has long been exposed to the world. The so-called Summit for Democracy will only go down in history as a manipulator and a saboteur of democracy.
Russia, which has also been excluded from the summit, already slammed it as a product of America's Cold War mentality and warned that it will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. This is a stance that experts have doubled down.
I think it's a dangerous game that the U.S. is playing. They're sort of drawing a line of division in the world and creating an us-against-them environment, just as they did with the Cold War against the Soviet Union.
The inclusion of some invitees, such as Israel, has also drawn strong criticism given the atrocities the regime has committed against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Irrespective of the names of invitees and those that have been excluded, the U.S. military adventurism seems to be overshadowing the summit. America's invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and its support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which have resulted in the loss of tens of thousands of innocent lives, challenge the U.S. claim of democracy promotion. Besides, humanitarian impacts of U.S. sanctions on countries that refuse to give in to its hegemony contradict such a claim. Ironically, the U.S. itself has a checkered record of human rights due to its racist approach toward minority groups, including African Americans. Advocates, analysts, and international observers have also cast a spotlight on voting rights in the United States ahead of the summit.
In recent times, clearly, the United States is not functioning as a democracy. It is functioning as a plutocracy. A democracy is a government of the people, by the people, for the people. A plutocracy is a government of the 1%, by the 1%, for the 1%.
A recent Harvard University poll found that over 50% of young people in the U.S. believe that the country's democracy is in trouble. With such an outlook, it remains to be seen how the U.S. wants to promote global democracy by holding a summit.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have Richard Becker, who's an anti-war activist from Answer Coalition, joining us from San Francisco. Also joining us is Frank Emspach, who's a political commentator, joining us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, Frank M. Spack, I'm going to start with you, and I'm going to go about what some reactions have been. This particular one saying Washington is trying to privatize the term democracy and create new dividing lines by hosting a summit for democracy, which runs counter to the trend of today's world. This coming from Russia. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I think what's so amazing about this summit is it looks like it's something that could have been done 50 years ago at the beginning of the Cold War. And that is what's so disturbing here, because we need to move in a different direction where we're not polarizing the planet, particularly when it is obvious that in places like Burma or Israel, that there are fundamental issues here about democracy. And that would be something to address. And based on the invitees and the content, things like that are not being addressed. Never mind the issues in this country, where there are real attempts to limit voter participation.
Okay. Let me come to you with this, Richard Becker, coming from Africa. Only less than one-third of countries there are invited to the Summit for Democracy, in which it has cast doubt on the true intention of the U.S. What do you think about Africa's stance?
Well, I think that this is just play-acting, this democracy summit, on the part of Biden and the U.S. administration. I don't think it's going to help them very much. I think there's a lot of ridicule going on around the world. But the exclusion of so many countries, the invitation to this was entirely based upon calculations, political calculations in Washington and about how to proceed. So the exclusion of most of the African countries, the exclusion of all of the Arab countries, I believe, except for Iraq. Is really quite remarkable. And all the countries that are on the U.S. enemies list right now, you know, Iran, China, Russia, Cuba, Venezuela, North Korea, they're all excluded. So in the name of democracy, we have, an exercise that is extremely undemocratic in its very structure.
So you talked about what we call West Asia. Let me ask you, Frank M. Spack, the reaction that some countries have had, where they called the so-called Summit for Democracy to be selective. They considered a political review based on American values. And I'm going to underline that word American values that they use, in which they say it will only instigate division and confrontation, and the U.S. democracy will do endless harm. This American values intertwined with democracy is something that the U.S. has preached, hasn't it? In respective countries. Why does the U.S. feel it can do that or want to do that, really?
Well, I don't know what their plan is to want to do that, except to maybe begin to build a consensus for more aggressive action. But this has been the standard thing since World War I with BB&O, the first public relations firm, always conflating anything that the United States does with democracy. Because most people in the world want to see a democratic system. They want to have the right to speak. They want to have all these things. And they see or saw the United States as leading so in these areas. So the notion of democracy is quite popular. So anytime you want to do something, it's always good to try to use the word in some fashion and mix it up with other things. Because one of the things about American values is that there aren't a set of American values that everybody agrees to, and in particular that the leading sectors of the society agree to. For instance, we don't have a democratic workplace in the United States. All employees, unless you have a union, are employees at will, meaning that the employer can fire them without cause, as long as it isn't for discriminatory reasons. Well, that's a pretty narrow vision of democracy, really. And so when we talk about American values, what's in the popular mind are the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, But what's in the real mind here is a much more narrow thing. And I think what's happening here is that that kind of sort of exposure is becoming more and more evident to people in the world. They don't say, they don't look to the United States as a leader. And I think the summit was an attempt to, or is an attempt to try to refurbish that image. It isn't going to work because the people fighting for democracy in the world, including some of the people in the Palestinians, including people in Burma, and including people in many, many places, are not invited. They're not considered to be Democrats or for democracy by the leaders of this country, and in fact, they are. And when you have that disconnect, this isn't going to work to move the United States forward in a positive direction, or anybody else for that matter.
Richard Brecker, Frank Imspach talked about how democracy and this notion that the U.S. Is using is causing some divisions around the world. Let's take a look at, for example, the invitees here. What do you think about the fact that the U.S. invites Taiwan but not China?
Well, that's a really important one. That's a very, very important issue and a very important question because February 28th of 2022 will mark the 50th anniversary of the 1972 Shanghai Communique. And in the Shanghai Communique, which was part of the opening of relations between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, and China, the People's Republic admission to the United Nations, was the agreement, the understanding expressed by the U.S. that there's one China. So now, and it said in that Shanghai Communique that. That people on both sides of the Taiwan Strait believed that. So there was the one China policy, and it was reinforced afterwards in a number of other communications that were made. So now you have the U.S. inviting the government of Taiwan as if it is an independent country. This is very dangerous. This is a very dangerous move in the direction of war for the U.S. to take this position. So it's, I think it's reckless. And I think it's very aggressive for the Biden administration to have invited Taiwan to this and excluded the real Chinese government, the government of the People's Republic.
One of the ones that was an eye-opener from this part of the world, Frank Imspach, when we take a look at it, is the fact that the U.S. says, consistent with the goals of the Summit for Democracy, the U.S. will use sanctions to counter serious human rights abuse and repressive acts across the world, is how they've termed it. They've actually promoted the idea of sanctions, saying that other governments need to use sanctions on other countries when these types of violations, for example, in the arena of human rights, is occurring. How dangerous is that to not only promote that, but of course exercise it?
Well, it's totally counterproductive. The other day there was an election in Venezuela. For local people, for the regions, and so on and so forth. And every single observer said that the level of participation was high, that the standards for meeting democratic, voting was high, that there were no problems, and that really it was pretty exemplary. And the net result was that the United States did nothing to drop its sanctions against Venezuela, which have caused tremendous hardship. So I don't think that the, in honesty, that sanctions can be very, very bad. They can hurt people. They cause people, I think, nations to become more oppressive. And because what happens is that you have a tremendous shortages and all kinds of stresses occur. And then even if the nation does what we allegedly wanted to do, it doesn't make any difference. That's what Venezuela shows. And, of course, Cuba, that's a whole other thing. But And, in fact, the net result of sanctions is to really attack the people in the country that we're supposedly supporting. And if we take a look at that with Iran or Iraq initially, or our threats with Russia, but the sanctions hurt the people. And the idea is that you cause enough disruption and the people will overthrow the government. Well, this is hardly a way to move forward.
When we take a look at this whole notion, Richard Brecker, it's something that the U.S. Perhaps wants to renovate or re-establish again or reinvent and more to give itself a stamp of approval, because around the world there are many who are questioning the U.S. in terms of its the way it used to be or the power that it had, and within that, the democracy that it promotes. When you take a look at the way that the U.S., for example, supports Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, the violations that take place there, the unwavering support that the U.S. has, or launching military interventions in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria. Do you think that this is so that the U.S. can renew its image of democracy around the world so it gains more respect?
Well, I think that's the idea of the Biden administration, but I think it's highly unlikely that that will be the outcome. I mean, there's many, many aspects to this. The United States is not really a democracy at all. There are some democratic rights that people have, which are being eroded seriously. And there are built-in aspects of the U.S. system which are highly undemocratic. For instance, I live here in a state, the state of California, 40 million people. It has two senators. The state of Wyoming has about 500,000 people, maybe a little bit more. It has two senators. How can that be regarded as democratic? It's not. It's not democratic at all. There are big attacks that are taking place inside the United States on people's right to vote, rolling back rights that were won through the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, and so forth. Fundamentally, from the very beginning, the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which encompass the rights, came from a very early period in the rise of capitalism in the world, and include no economic or social rights, only political rights, and only for a limited part of the population. Now, the struggle was to expand those, but to larger parts of the population. Things like give an example. In 1996 was the World Food Summit in Rome, sponsored by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. And in the final communique of that, which included a reference to the right of people to have food, the United States government said that, quote, any attainment of the, quote, right to food, end quote, or, quote, fundamental right to be free from hunger is a goal, an aspiration. In other words, the United States government wanted to go on record, and this was the Clinton administration, but it continues till today, to say that there is, from the point of view of the United States government, no right to food, that's only an aspiration, no right to housing, no right to health care, no right to those things that make life livable for people. So we have a very narrow presentation in the United States of what democracy means or what democratic rights mean. And still to today, the official position of the U.S. government is that those economic rights are not applicable.
Okay. Frank Emspach, I was listening to their Richard Becker and wondering which points in the U.S. that is not undemocratic, I should ask you. But I'm going to refer to the UN rapporteur who paid a visit recently to the U.S. And the one thing that stood out was one of the things there that Richard Becker talked about, and that is the rights of Americans when it comes to voting, and especially when it comes to minorities like African Americans, and a slew of state laws restricting voting rights. What is going on there? And again, doesn't that put into question the notion of democracy?
What's going on here is an attempt by the Republican Party and the most authoritarian parts of it and those corporations that support it to find a way to maintain minority rule here, minority white rule, I might add, here in the United States, no matter what the vote is. And so all of these different maneuvers in the last 6 months or a year since the Trump defeat and the Electoral College and the election in general are to limit the right to vote, to have the ability of state legislators to intervene, who might be Republicans, and overturn votes, to make it harder for people to vote, to make it a crime to give somebody water while they're standing online for 5 hours waiting to vote. And, it fits in with a whole other thing. Why do we vote on Tuesday? It's a work day in this country. And most places do not allow people to go out of work to go vote. So you're talking about systemic methods in this country that have been under litigation fighting for years to limit the franchise, to find ways to make it more difficult to vote. And that is the situation. What's happening now is that you have, for the first time, I think, and certainly in my lifetime, and I think all of us, you have a group of people who are saying they're prepared to overthrow the government and try to and say that the elections are fake, the elections are not real, and call into question the very viability of this system. And that is different. That is different. And the attacks on the franchise now are part of that thinking. And that is a different kind of, I think, crisis that we have, and an attack on the basic notion of democracy, and very, very scary as a result.
Final question goes to you, Richard Becker, and we have to talk about this, and that is the U.S. wars, especially with the notion of regime change when it is the motivation behind it. We know that the U.S. has tried to do that, whether it's Iraq, whether we're talking about Syria, or with the Islamic Republic, trying to place their notion of democracy. And it's failed when it comes to Syria, for example. So many people to have been displaced, so many deaths. Doesn't that, again, put into question?
I mean, these wars.
Go ahead.
The undemocratic thing imaginable is the wars and the continue. To say you made a reference earlier to Israel and the Palestinians, the 2 million people in Gaza are locked into the biggest open-air prison in the world. In the West Bank, there are two different legal systems. The settlers are subject, the illegal settlers are subject to Israeli law. The Palestinians who live there are subject to emergency military regulations left over from British colonialism, and they're found guilty every single time, virtually, that they're charged. So, you know, and so it's just the most utter hypocrisy to see Israel represented in this, this conference on democracy.
Thank you very much. We're going to end there. Richard Becker, who's an anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition, thank you for your comments from San Francisco. Frank Imsbach, thank you, political commentator who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, it's goodbye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Back to reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I'm in the studio here today. I'm Muzaffar Haider. Can we have a short introduction from both of you? Would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm Mahdi, and I've been a student of Hausa for the past 7 years. Let's keep it that short.
MashaAllah, MashaAllah, 7 years. It's going to be 10 soon, inshaAllah. Brother Mahdi, welcome to the show. And yourself?
My name is Abdullah Al-Musawi, also a student of the Hausa.
Alhamdulillah.
Yeah.
And where are you from?
Well, down under.
You're from down under?
Down under. Let's see if we will get to realize what down under is. If you don't, Google it. I'm not going to say it.
That's Australia, guys. Down under.
Come on, don't spoil it.
They're not going to Google it. They're sitting in their cars and stuff, and we might cause an accident because they'll try and
now
find
they
out
have Siri. They could say, Siri, Google down under.
Well, down under.
And she'll be like, down under is Australia. There you go.
Australia. It makes sense.
But where about in Australia?
Melbourne.
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 No, it's male.
Male.
No, it's okay. I'm trying to be I'm trying to go against the feminists and call it male born, not a female born. Play with the words.
Well, that explains why you mentioned swinging from the trees. I mean, Australia is that kind of a place.
It is. It's a giant jungle.
It's a giant jungle. Yeah.
Why is there almost no life in the middle of those Australia?
Yeah, you can say that,
Brother Mahdi. Yeah. Where are you from?
Originally, I'm Iranian. I was born in Iran, and I lived in the United States for a long time.
Okay. All right, so I'm struggling to figure out whether I should trust you guys. I mean, you're all from different countries. I'm from the UK. Why should I trust an Australian and a guy from the US who is originally Iranian? And
you can trust me. Do you know why?
Why?
Because your queen is my queen.
My
I'm my queen, too.
No, you're from America.
Well,
you guys don't have a queen.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's kind of like the grandmother.
We paved the ground for you guys, and then you killed all the Indians.
So how much can you trust someone based on their appearance? It's a big question. I want to throw it at you now. How much?
First and foremost, what is coming to the eyes and the very first impression is what that you can't get a second chance of making it. So the first impression is very important, I believe. So us as religious people or claiming to be practically Muslim, when we see someone who is having like a man who's having a beard or a lady who has a good hijab, that usually wins a big bit of our trust. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we fail because we trust them and just based on how they look. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we fail. We see the consequences of the not having enough of research before mm-hmm. trusting someone. But there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'min alayhi salam: in your friendship, put in all your kindness, but never invest all of your trust in a friend.
If only I had heard that before, it would have saved me from so many perils. Invest all of your kindness, give all your kindness, give all your affection, all of your love, but don't give all of your trust.
Exactly.
That's a really good starting point.
Because trust is only meant to be for Allah. Mm-hmm. That's the only one that we have to invest all of our trust into. Mm-hmm. That's whom we should invest our trust. If anyone else who is a creature, if we invest all of our trust with, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will test us with that.
Right. We're speaking about whether I should trust you guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Said Abdullah, Sheikh Mehdi raised a very interesting point here. It's about that immediate visual kind of impression that you get. And he raised the, you know, the hijab for women, the big beard for brothers, etc. How does that play a role in you trusting someone?
Trusting people, that's a nice one. Psychologically, though, I've read somewhere that says those who have chubby faces, people seem to trust them more. So
I can get trusted easier.
I trusted you
the moment you walked through the
door. There you go. So psychology has a
problem. So probably having a smile on face can add into that?
Yeah, so obviously.
A chubby face with a big smile.
Exactly. Well, I mean, if you look at it from a psychological perspective, you can tell that it actually people trust based on appearance. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. If you have a common ground with the appearance itself. So, for example, when I come to the Middle East, I come to the Muslim countries, I feel more relaxed, more at ease, because like I think that, you know, people share the same as faith as mine and stuff like that. So my trust level goes up, goes a lot higher. And the closer you get to people, you start to trust them. But I think the foundation of dealing with people has to be based on you trusting them. You know, there's a hadith. Okay. Oh, not a hadith, actually. There's an event that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam one day, I can't remember the name of the companion, that came to him, and the Prophet kind of like frowned and turned away from him, and he said to him, why? He said, you killed a person. And that person, he heard the story that he saw a Jew, a shepherd Jew, or an atheist, I don't know. And the guy saw the Muslims, he got scared, he said, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, and he announced the Shahada. So the guy says, nah, you're just faking it, he killed him. The Prophet says to him, how do you know what's in his heart? You know, even if he wasn't truly saying it because he believed, he was just trying to save his life, how do you know what was in his heart? How could you do such an action? So, and obviously, with the rest of the hadith that we have, that dealing with people, like if I have to deal with you, I can't come approach you based on the fact that you might do harm to me and approach you with hate and animosity and, you know, that's not going to help, is it? So if I come, I come with love, peace, and trust. At least like the brother said with the hadith, not give you full trust, but at least I begin with trusting you to begin with and see how you progress. You know how Amir al-Mu'minin says, أَحْبِبْ حَبِيبَكَ هَوْنًا, that if you want to love your friend, love him a little, don't go too much. وَبْغَضْ حَبِيبَ عَدُوَكَ هَوْنًا, even your enemy, if you want to hate him less. Don't hate him too much. Because then the Imam says, there might come a time where your habib, your lover, becomes your enemy, and your enemy becomes what? Your lover. So you, how you approach them is makes a lot of difference. So I approach people generally with the intention of trusting them. If they cross me, that's when I know that they're not trustworthy. But like the brother said, I won't give them my full trust, but I begin with trust.
Sheikh Mehdi, I'm going to backtrack again here because we raised the idea of somebody's face and their looks and that initial impression that we get about them. So let's come back to that for a moment. Now, to what extent is somebody's inside, interior realm? As Sayed mentioned, how do you know what's inside their heart? The question here is, to what extent does somebody's inner realm, their true personality, reflect on the outside?
Well, what I think, I mean, backtracking to what my dear brother said from down under, vice versa of what he said is also I've experienced and I've seen to be true. I've witnessed that sometimes we intend to not trust people with similar looks. You're like, you go to Australia and you have a bad experience with a Muslim. A Muslim steals your money, or you have a bad experience at the masjid. You're going to be like, I'm not going to trust any Muslim anymore. I'm not going to. You're just going to like.
So you generalize, basically.
Exactly, generalize and flag out and be like, okay, anyone who is not Muslim, I trust first. So the vice versa is in certain experiences true.
But does that have anything to do with looks, though?
Sometimes it does. I mean,
no, I mean, this is based on experience, and you just generalize it.
Well, sometimes we discriminate people based on their looks too. I mean, we're like, I'm going to trust white people.
So that's the question that the brother raised.
Upper class of the societies that we live in. But my point is this: you say that how much the interior, the words, and you know what they say helps in terms of winning our trust. I believe that, I mean, the more we grow, the more we learn, the more we get experienced, possibly that comes with the age, we learn that we shouldn't trust easily, and we shouldn't judge based on